A generation ago, Americans could have told you very clearly what the military does. It defends or retakes territory. If you asked soldiers or sailors what they did for a living, they also had clear answers as well. Today, the vast majority of these men and women spend their time quite differently. They analyze lines of computer code in Virginia office buildings, train Afghan judges and parliamentarians, build isolation wards in Ebola-ravaged Liberia, launch agricultural reform programs in Africa, and conduct anti-piracy patrols off the Somali coast, and develop television soap operas for audiences in Pakistan and Iraq. You name it, the military does it. Rosa Brooks writes about this in her new book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. Rosa is a senior fellow at New America, a columnist for foreign policy, and a law professor at Georgetown University. She previously worked at the Pentagon as counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. In 2001, she was awarded the Secretary of Defense Medal for Outstanding Public Service. Again, the name of the book is How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Rosa Brooks to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. It's good to be here.
It's very nice to have you here. Give us a sense of how this whole project came to be and how you decided to take this on.
You know, in some ways, this project has been going on for 10 years or more. I started thinking about the issues the book talks about really right after the September 11th attacks. But my thinking underwent transformation. In some ways, my views accelerated. In other ways, they changed when I went and I worked at the Pentagon for a couple of years early in the Obama administration, working in the office of the Secretary of Defense on a wide range of policy issues. And that was very, very eye-opening.
The point of the book ultimately, and obviously we can talk more about it and clarify this, but that there was a time when it was very clear as to what the military did in defending our countries. And if you ask soldiers and sailors what they did for a living, they had a clear answer. And your point here is that those answers aren't so clear anymore.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And this is not because the military is just confused and messed up. This is because the world has just gotten so complicated as a result of the technological changes of the last few decades, as a result of globalization. At the moment, I think we don't really quite know what war is anymore, and because we don't know what war is, we don't know what tasks should be military tasks and what should be civilian tasks. And looking at everything from non-state actors involved in terrorism that crosses borders, but people who are not part of any state's military, looking at cyber, et cetera, that increasingly we're facing threats that I think it would have really been hard to conceive of 30, 40, 50 years ago. They just look so different, but now we see them through the lens of war and we ask our military to deal with them.
The book is very much a story about what happened, and it is not a memoir, but it certainly touches on your story, which is a fascinating one. You're a senior fellow at New America, a columnist for foreign policy, a law professor at Georgetown. You did work at the Pentagon as counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And then there is your family background as well, which is that your wife of an Army Green Beret and your parents were very much involved in the peace movement. As were you.
They were.
As were you.
As was I, as a small child. Yeah, I was a child soldier in the anti-war movement. Now, some of my earliest memories are protest marches. I have a memory from the age of four sitting in a picnic blanket in Central Park at the celebration for the end of the Vietnam War. And many clear memories of making homemade banners and posters to protest the requirement that young men register for the draft that was reimposed in 1980. I spent most of my time as a little kid walking on picket lines and in protest marches. My mother likes to say that I was tear gassed in utero at an anti-war march and that this accounts for anything odd about me. So it was not a natural progression to end up working at the Defense Department and marrying an Army officer.
But this does inform your experiences, and it does, these experiences have allowed you to live through many of the contradictions that are inherent in our military.
I think so. I think I came to all of these issues as someone who, for better or for worse, was sort of struggling to reconcile sometimes diametrically opposing perspectives on the role of the military, whether war was always evil or sometimes necessary, whether the role of the military was always evil or a good thing and a wonderful thing. And I think coming at these issues from that perspective sometimes lets you make different connections and see different things than people coming at it from one perspective. But I think for me, you know, growing up, starting off thinking of the military as at best a necessary evil and usually an unnecessary evil, but then seeing the really important role that the U.S. military played in the Balkans and elsewhere in the 1990s, saving lives and peace building, then going from that to the post 9/11 world, watching that same military really struggling to figure out, what do you do when the enemy is no longer identifiable? What do you do when the enemy doesn't wear a uniform, doesn't use anything we think of as weapons, doesn't reside in any particular place, and when all your training is geared towards fighting an enemy that at least acknowledges that they are your enemy? How do you transform institutionally? What does this mean for law?
How much of the transformation that we have seen was planned in the sense of, okay, we see this shifting, we see this moving, now we have to plan for those shifts? And or how much of it is, do you believe, that we have had to transform on the fly, and with that comes some chasms?
Well, we're always playing catch up, and I think in Iraq and Afghanistan, for instance, the military suddenly had to struggle to figure out, you know, what do you do if you're fighting counterinsurgency kinds of battles? This is not something we'd never done in the past. We very much were trying to do it in Vietnam, but in some ways it was a set of skills that had been forgotten after the triumphs of the first Gulf War. And so you're always playing catch up, trying to figure out, well, how do you handle non-state actor terrorism? How do you handle cyber threats? How do you handle around the corner bioengineered viruses, non-lethal weapons, autonomous weapons? It's like always playing catch up. I do think, though, that the military, partly because it is the only part of the U.S. government at this point that is really fully funded, has a unique ability that is in some ways unrivaled in other parts of the government to dedicate people to doing nothing but sitting around and thinking about the future. So in some sense, I think some of the most interesting conversations about what the future is going to look like, what the kinds of threats there will be for the United States, what kinds of opportunities there will be, whether you want to think about things like, you know, what impact will climate change have, to something like what impact will further technological developments in artificial intelligence have. You know, the military does have people trying to do it, but it bumps up against the fact that everything about the way the military itself is structured in terms of recruiting and training, in terms of how Congress divides up oversight responsibilities, makes it very, very hard for the really interesting ideas that do get generated within the military to get translated into actual practice.
With that said, you point out in the book that we are, as the military puts it, in an era of persistent conflict and that it won't end soon. Are we ready for that then?
I don't think we are. I think we're still, as a nation, in denial. I think the military is less in denial, perhaps, than most of the rest of the United States. But I think as a nation, we still think of war as something that has a clear beginning and end. And that we have one set of legal rules for wars, which are looser than our legal rules for peacetime, and that's okay because war is this, you know, it's a temporary state of exception to ordinary life. And we still have this fantasy in a way that we will just go back at some point to not being in a war. I think that's unlikely to happen. I think just the very diffuse kinds of threats that we are facing now and are likely to face into the next few decades at least, they're just not going to go away. And even if we are fortunate enough, as we may be, to avoid any major, you know, ground combat situations or major, major conflicts with other states, we're still going to be in this situation of sort of semi-permanent semi-covert, shadowy conflicts in which we're both going to be using lethal force, killing people, but we're also going to be trying to combat these much sort of squishier, fuzzier kinds of threats, and that's going to be constant, and the expansion of the military that results from that is going to be ongoing, and I do think that most Americans are still sort of in denial about that fact.
So how do you have persistent and, to use your word, squishy, and also
that's the technical military term.
the Pentagon term, squishy, but to also have transparency and accountability when it comes to these issues?
That, I think, is the single biggest challenge, right? So step one, as with everything in life, right, is admit you've got a problem and recognize where you are and stop being in denial. But the second step is we've got oversight and accountability mechanisms that were designed based on this assumption that war is really easy to identify and it's got a beginning and an end and it's bounded geographically. You know, the war is here but not here. Switzerland is neutral. France is at war, et cetera. And that the enemy is easy to identify. And so all of our mechanisms for saying, how do we know that we're not just committing abuses as opposed to doing militarily necessary things, all those mechanisms are sort of linked to this, at this point, kind of anachronistic framework of wars that rarely exist anymore. I think that the challenge in this era of cyber conflict and this era of drone warfare, things that don't look exactly like war but don't look exactly like peace, is to figure out how we develop mechanisms that bring what's in the covert world sufficiently out into the open to make sure that we're doing it responsibly, we're doing it in a way that doesn't set terrible international precedents, we're doing it in a way that is consistent with the values that we care about. And right now we don't have that. Right now a lot of it is we apply the legal rules for war even though the fit is not that good, because the legal rules for peace don't fit that well either. And a lot of stuff just slips through the cracks right now.
Another theme of the book is that we keep on piling new tasks onto our military. Add this, do this, add this to the pile. And what does that do to our preparedness for the threats that we face as a nation?
I think it's very much as one of my colleagues, retired Army Lieutenant General Dave Barno, put it turns the military into Walmart. It turns it into an organization that provides absolutely everything, but does it in a way that is cheap, efficient, but not necessarily of the highest quality. And it can be kind of demoralizing for the military itself when it starts being the purveyor of all things to all people, but never has the ability to really focus on doing anything very well. And I think right now we've put the military in a sort of impossible situation where we're saying to people, at one and the same time, we want you to be prepared to fight wars the old-fashioned way. You know, we want you to be able prepared on short notice, if necessary, to wage tank battles and crawl through the mud and get into firefights and shoot down enemy planes. And yet at the same time, we expect you to be able to help launch microfinance programs for Afghan women. We expect you to be able to train Iraqi judges. We expect you to be able to prevent human trafficking in the Pacific. We expect you to be able to essentially do everything, stop malaria, stop Ebola, fight cyber wars. And even for an institution that is as large and well-funded as the military, it's kind of a schizophrenic set of roles. And what ends up happening is that the military sort of reverts to, hey, wait a minute, we're here to fight. And if you ask us to do this other stuff, we'll do it because we follow orders. But we're not necessarily going to do it well because we don't want to be doing it. We don't think we should be doing it, so we're going to do it kind of badly, which is not a recipe for either institutional success or for national success.
You add, using the Walmart analogy, that the tempting one-stop shopping convenience it offers has a devastating effect on smaller, more traditional enterprises, in this case, the State Department and other civilian foreign policy agencies. What has the impact been on the State Department and these other agencies?
Well, it's kind of a vicious circle. The more we ask the military to do, the bigger the military's budget needs to be, the more legal authorities we need to give to the military. The more money we give to the military, the less there is to go around for everybody else, such as the State Department, USAID. So those agencies have really seen their budgets cut or frozen in recent years. the less money they have, the less they can do, and they can't do what they do as well as they used to be able to do it. And so Congress and the White House look at them and say, well, you did a bad job or you can't do this, so we're going to go ask the military to do it instead, and then the cycle kind of repeats itself. I mean, they basically get sort of squeezed out. And, you know, part of it is just sheer size, that we as a nation, we have invested very, very heavily in our defense agencies, in the military itself, and in related agencies, the intelligence community, Homeland Security, and so forth. We have really underinvested in developing the capabilities of civilian organizations, and it's often said, and it is true. I checked once because it sounded like one of those things people say, but maybe it wasn't actually true. People say that there are more members of military marching bands than there are members of the U.S. Foreign Service who work for the State Department. It turns out that is not only true, but there are quite a lot more member of military marching bands than Foreign Service officers, which is kind of shocking, because not to knock military marching bands, which are great, but when you think, well, what does the nation urgently need? Do we need more marching bands, or do we need more diplomats and development experts? It's a pretty sad comment on our national priorities, that we can fund the marching bands, but we seem totally incapable of funding the diplomats and development experts we need.
The last line of the front book jacket is, and time is running out to make things right. Looking at your timeline, and I guess this ultimately becomes a question of optimism, where are you at in this?
Guardedly in between optimism and pessimism, I guess. You know, on the one hand, I'm really cheered by the fact that within the military itself, the important conversations that need to take place are taking place. And the reception for my book has actually been particularly positive from within those communities. So I think that within the military, people are very much saying, hey, this is an untenable state of affairs. What do we need to do to change it? And that's a really good thing, and it gives me some hope. The pessimism is that in terms of the national-level political leadership, both in the White House and in Congress, and both this, I'm speaking about both parties very much, I don't see any real political will to change things dramatically. And on the contrary, in some of the areas where I'm most worried, such as the sort of disappearance of large swathes of U.S. foreign policy into the covert world, where, you know, who knows what's going on? We can't evaluate whether it's being done well or poorly or responsibly or abusively. I don't see any move to change that. And when it comes to things like covert warfare and the use of drone strikes and targeted killings, I worry that we have set ourselves on a path where we are setting really dangerous precedents that other states that are much less responsible than the U.S. are going to follow. And when I say that, I mean specifically states such as Russia, states such as the Iranians and North Koreans. And we've created a set of precedents and practices where if Vladimir Putin decides to kill political dissidents and then say, what can I say? They were terrorists. The evidence is secret. It's classified, but we have it. I'm sure you understand. It would be really hard for us to respond.
The name of the book is How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Rosa Brooks, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon by Rosa Brooks. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.